thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
All right, well, welcome to the second annual live broadcast of the Digital Campus podcast from That Camp Prime. Wow, it sounds so good. This is so much better than staring at my wall in the office. We are here at on the lovely campus of George Mason University, where it's a beautiful day, and many unwise people are inside in the basement of the engineering building to watch the live broadcast of the podcast. We are brought to you today, once again, by Grad Hacker. Grad Hacker returning to sponsor the second annual live broadcast at gradhacker.org.
And the podcast is recording lots of episodes here.
And with their podcast this year, which has led to great fame and riches. We're also brought to you by four great websites. Have you lost your history? Well, Tom Scheinfeld has found it. And you can too at foundhistory.org. Let's welcome Tom Scheinfeld. Is your education tired? Get it wired at edwired.org. The subversive and possibly illegal site of Mills Kelly. No haters, please. Mills Kelly, everyone. Only one Digital Campus host is a triple threat of musical talent, literary knowledge, and That Camp organizational mojo. Why not mosey over to AmandaFrench.net right now? Amanda French. And finally, if you're looking for the latest views by someone named Dan Cohen, U.S. News and World Report recently rated DanCohen.org as the third best site for Dan Cohen-related opinions. Hi, everyone. Okay, we hope that people are admiring our legs on the live broadcast. All right, it's a little risque. Okay, great. So welcome to the podcast, everyone. We wanted to do a live broadcast. So we're going to ask for questions from the audience. We're also taking questions via Twitter and anyone watching on Ustream, even though you're 5 seconds behind. And so we're going to just kick right in. We have some stories that people throughout ahead of time, but if someone would like to take the mic, we've got the audience mic'd right now. Who'd like to kick us off? That's George Brett's legs that you saw in front of the camera. Here he is.
George Brett, I'll walk around back to go back to the chair. I just want to say thank you all. This is about the third or fourth That Camp here that I've had the opportunity to attend. And my first digital humanities conference was in 1983. In Raleigh, Virginia. And it was just a bunch of old faculty members standing at a podium with stacks of paper that they read to us. The only exciting person was a guy who came up in Western boots and a Western hat by the name of Dave Hughes. And on the podium, he put a Radio Shack Model 100. And he said, "I am the cyber cowboy. And I am a poet, and I write with light." And what he meant was the light of on the display of this notebook, which is about the size of actually Amanda's machine. And this is so much more exciting and so much more fun, Mills, you were talking about fun, than anything that I've been since. And thank you all for Amanda. You do great work. Thanks.
Thank you very much, George. Wow, that was a very nice introduction. All right. Who would like to debate us on anything? Brian, I'm looking at you. You're close to the mic. Okay, I'll let everyone think. Well, new story from this week, a new publishing venture called PeerJ. With a new twist, oriented toward biomedical sciences. We've talked a lot about open access publishing. This is indeed an open access buffet. Is that a way that we can call it? All you can publish for between $99 and $299. It is from the former leader of PLOS One, which is the Public Library of Sciences, sort of all you can publish with the subvention fee of whatever it is, $1,500. Anyone on the panel like to kick us off?
Sure.
Yeah.
Here's Tom. I'm excited to see this. I mean, I think we're at a phase in publishing where we need experiments like this one. We need for-profit and non-profit experiments in digital publishing. And this has some great people behind it, so I'm very glad to see it. I think the big question with this, whether it will be successful, is sort of the question with all of these new publishing efforts, including our own Press Forward, is a lot of it is the question of establishing a brand. Will they be able to gain traction in the marketplace with a new brand? In many ways, that's what university presses are. They are, you know, we you know, if you publish with Chicago, well, we think that must be a good book. You know, if you publish with someone else, well, maybe that's not quite as good. I think that's the challenge for them. So, and that will involve bringing a lot of people along. It will involve publishing some good material, and in the sciences, it will involve high citation metrics. So we'll see if they can establish a brand. I think that's going to be the real challenge.
Yeah, I wanted one of the things we've talked about a lot on the podcast is the future of the university press and these kinds of academic journals. And I think that these kinds of models hold the promise for a future revenue model. It's not the same revenue model as the expensive journal or the expensive, you know, biological journals are very expensive, but this is a way at this revenue generation problem that all of these presses have run up against. And so I think I agree with Tom that if they can establish a brand that people actually care about, that publishing in PeerJ matters the same way that it matters to publish in some more important or better known journal, then I think we're looking, if these kinds of things really work, then we are looking at the model that will bring about the demise of the conventional journal.
I read a little bit about this, and one of the things that I find interesting about it is that I'm not sure whether it's competing with other open access journals or with closed access journals, if that's even a term, really. I know, you know, because in a way it almost seems like a model that is competitive with other open access publications, you know. Oh, instead of paying for every single article, you can pay and become a lifetime member, which is a kind of it's a pretty good business model, but it's one that doesn't, on the face of it, have, it's not any different from the other open access challenges to things like Oxford University Press or something, or Elsevier or Springer or anything like that. And I did read a little bit about this, and even still, analysts, financial analysts who are analyzing whether Elsevier can keep its 37% profit or whatever it is that it makes, they still are not worried about it. Maybe they will be, but from what I've read, they've said, no, we still think that people, you know, only a minority really understand the open access value, and we still think that large private publishing companies like Elsevier and its SpringerLink, Blackwell, will continue to dominate the market.
Yeah, before we move on to the next topic, you know, I did have some thoughts about this week in terms of, you know, they are focusing on the sciences, and I was thinking, just as a historian of science, not to get too profound, we never get profound on the podcast here, or knowledgeable, actually, either. But I was thinking about, you know, Thomas Kuhn's distinction between normal science and revolutionary science, and that I think we're seeing some testing of the waters here of just, like, PLOS ONE and PURE J are for normal science, which Kuhn defined as, you know, the, like, figuring out the standard models that happen in most sciences. There's always going to be a nature or science for when they find the God particle under the sofa of the universe at the Large Hadron Collider. There'll always be a branded journal that will take that article. But there's a lot of science that goes on, you know, maybe 99% of it, which is you know, getting that last decimal place on a particular variable or trying out an existing theory in a new part of a field. It's just the everyday science that goes on. And I think what PLOS ONE showed by now publishing thousands of articles a month is that as long as there's just an open repository that people can kind of dump the normal day-to-day science that they do in the lab into a repository that people can find, that's a great thing. And I think what PureJ is doing is extending that, and also I think, as the sort of market watchers will say, testing the lows for how cheap you can go for normal science. That I think, sure, Nature will still have a big editorial staff and charge a lot of money, and there'll always be room for that. But there, it may be that, at least in science, and this is where I'm kind of interested, is maybe this is very different than the humanities, where we think everything we do is important. I think scientists will admit that sometimes they're just sort of cutting out, right? They've got a big database of gene studies, and they're pumping out 20 articles on that particular test trial run. So they have this need for a kind of buffet of normal science, but in the humanities and history, maybe not. So I think there's something interesting here, perhaps, if, again, without getting too profound, about the landscape of scholarly publishing in the sciences.
Sure.
I actually just wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to the Modern Language Association, which not long ago established author agreements for all of its journals that it publishes, saying, yes, if you publish with us, you retain the copyright, you have the right to post it in an open repository and things like that. So just while we're on the topic of open access in the humanities, it's maybe not a huge news story, but I thought it was obviously great.
Great. No, I think it's an important point. All right, Brian, come on. Come on up, step to the mic.
So I wanted to pick up the Twitter conversation we had earlier this week with Audrey Waters about Apple's move away from potential move away from educational computing devices. So I'll just throw that out. Apple has discontinued the white MacBook a while ago. Throughout 2011, schools could still get it for some time. They can't get it now. There is a $1,000 laptop available, and there are plenty of PC laptops available as well. So chew on that.
Okay, great. Just to repeat it, if people couldn't hear at home, and it'd be great if on the Twitter stream someone could tell me if you can hear the audience at home. But Brian Croxall mentioned that with the announcements from Apple's WWDC meeting this week, they dropped actually a kind of low-end laptop that if you've been in elementary school recently, there's a lot of these in those environments, often like on carts, and they're sort of brought to the classroom to use. And Audrey Waters on her blog, and we'll link to this from the show notes, noted that now Apple sort of implicitly, and I think partly explicitly now, recommending that schools go with the iPad, which really is a big sea change. If you grew up like I did, you know, trying out stuff at the command line on Apple II, you are now being forced into an environment where you can't get to the command line and you're only using sanctioned apps from the App Store, a very different environment than a kind of open computer, if that's where they're pushing it. So great question. Mills, you've been covering education.
Yeah, I'm not, I have to say, I saw Audrey's post about this, and I'm really not happy to see the especially younger people being forced into this app only environment of the iPad, and for some of the reasons that Dan said, but also the iPad is not so much a computing device as it is a watching device and a watching and listening device, and so I think that, you know, for the purposes of, and not honestly, not that many people in education are using laptops to their full capacity, especially at the sort of K-6 level, but some are. And now if this is the situation that they're going to find themselves in, they're not going to be able to do that. They'll have to find some other vehicle for doing that. Okay, so they can buy inexpensive PC-based laptops, but then you get into the problem of, well, is the school an Apple school or is it a PC school? And they, having spent a lot of time in my own children's elementary school, you know, they're working with one kind of technology and not the other. So they're either a PC school or they're an Apple school, and they just simply can't afford to do both at the same time. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how it goes, but I'm bothered by this.
I think one thing to note in all of this is that Apple hasn't been a very good partner to education for a long time now. I think, you know, those of us who grew up in the 1980s, we fondly remember Apple IIs and the Mac and Apple giving educational discounts to students and their parents and to schools. It's been an awful long time since Apple did that. You know, try to get Apple to donate some free equipment to your center or institute or department. Doesn't happen. And PC manufacturers do occasionally do stuff like that. I mean, Microsoft has been generous enough to give us lanyards. more than lanyards. Very generous donation to that camp. But Apple, even considering that, you know, everybody in this room, most of the people in this room are using Macs, it would be very hard to get Apple to give us any kind of sponsorship for that camp. So first thing I'll say is Apple hasn't been a very good partner for a very long time. I think the open computing environment is one problem with moving to the iPad. I think the other problem is this thing. I think the keyboard is still going to be the input interface of choice for businesses for a long time. And just from a, you know, purely from a pragmatic standpoint of teaching kids to, you know, giving them the skills they need to work in a normal business and to get a job, I think they need to know how to use one of these for quite a bit longer. I think so. I think probably teachers and principals and administrators know that, and so I'm wondering how quickly the iPad will really catch on.
I don't think this invalidates the points that any of you have made. I will say that I'm definitely in favor of not creating special devices for K through 12. I do think that, you know, you should use, they should get used to the devices that they will use when they're older, you know what I mean? So I do agree with you that I would rather that would be a laptop, at least in addition to an iPad. But I've never thought it was necessary, just as an uninformed opinion, to create special devices for younger kids. You just have to relearn it later.
Great. Alex.
Well, 6 months ago, we had That Camp AHA, which was great. So I figured I'd ask some of the historians what That Camp's going to look like in New Orleans. And maybe, Amanda, if you could segue it into a discussion of the next phase of That Camp's and long-term plans for how they might appear in other disciplinary venues. But I'd also like to specifically ask how the digital will look in general at New Orleans and how the program's shaping out from your standpoint, or predictions on how it might look and how people might interact with that space in a different way than they did with Chicago.
First thing I could say is it's probably going to be a beerier That Camp. Okay, here's Amanda with a more serious answer.
Sure. Yeah, obviously they're just in the very beginning planning stages, so they don't know too much about what that camp will look like. It will be longer. It will be a full day, because that was one of the big comments from the evaluations, that I think it started at something like 11 o'clock in the morning, and that was too short a time. So that's that. I'm actually really glad you asked me about the future of That Camp, because I actually just realized, I think about 2 days ago, that I haven't blogged about that or announced any of that, and there's actually quite a bit to announce. So we had a very generous grant from the Mellon Foundation for 2 years, from 2010 to 2012. That ended March 31st. Most of what that grant did, it was seed money for That Camp, and it, you know, I mean, talk about large oaks from little acorns grow. This was kind of a whole forest that began from an acorn, as far as I'm concerned. We're now up to something like, it's about 105 That Camps that have ever either, you know, happened or are planned to happen since 2008, which is pretty amazing, you know, all over the world. In that first 2 years, we were really setting up an infrastructure to support this kind of thing. You know, we have a website, it's running WordPress multi-site so that people can have their own That Camp websites. We wrote a good bit of documentation about how to organize a That Camp. Mellon's funding paid for me, which, you know, and I've been sort of just supporting That Camp organizers in a facilitative capacity more than anything, some fellowships so that people could go to That Camp, and various other little labor costs, mainly labor costs associated with getting That Camp running. So in the next couple of years, our main goal is to make That Camp even more of a community-supported endeavor than it is already. It's already mostly the community. it's a huge community of That Campers, people who just pop out of the woodwork to organize That Camps. And my role, you know, very often winds up being, great, good job, awesome, you know, like a little bit of advice, a little bit of a sounding board, certainly answering questions. But I am, you know, for the next 2 years, it's going to be the goal of my life to phase out my own position, actually. And so a lot of what we can do a lot of that work, actually, I think, with technology. We're doing a big redesign of thatcamp.org this summer, and we're going to basically make it much more like a social network. We're going to implement BuddyPress on thatcamp.org so that you can do a lot more viewing of things across That Camps. You'll be able to see, you know, which That Camps a particular person has been to. You'll be able to sort of browse by topic across That Camps, all kinds of stuff like that. In addition, you know, we really need sort of user forums where people can answer each other's questions, and where the questions that I kind of answer over and over again, you know, have a particular home. We get that into the documentation as fast as we can. We need a lot more stuff written for people who are coming to That Camp rather than people who are organizing That Camps. The other thing, you know, the other plank in the platform of sustainability for That Camp is really getting higher education leaders to understand what That Camp is and why they should support it. So another thing that we're going to do is, and I think we're currently planning this for fall of 2013, we're going to have a special invitation-only That Camp, I think, or at least invitation mostly That Camp, which will be a lot of people who have organized That Camps already, and university leaders and scholarly association leaders, provosts, deans, presidents, heads of scholarly associations. And we're going to have a That Camp for them so that they will have had the experience of going to one, and so they can hear from a lot of the organizers about why it's important and what they get out of it, what communities get out of it. So we're going to have a special event. So those are our plans for the next couple of years. We think That Camp can be run. I think most of the stuff I do, to be honest, a lot of it is just like maintaining the website, answering email, it's stuff like that. We think a lot of the stuff that I do can be handled by a volunteer community, particularly because of That Camp community is so strong and vibrant right now. So that's the other thing we're going to do, is kind of try to put that together, figure out exactly what kind of form that'll take. Tom, anything to add to that?
Right, and yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, there is a That Camp coming up at MLA in January, as well as at AHA. We're actually seeing a lot more. That's definitely something that has been happening a lot more, that scholarly societies are wanting to have That Camps as pre-conference activities. The College Art Association just signed up to have a That Camp. So certainly, I think MLA and AHA are the two most important scholarly societies, you know, in America. But there are plenty of other ones that are equally as important.
Mark Sample on Twitter asked about the press forward That Camp proceeding. So there'll also be writing and projects that have been highlighted. The best of those will go into a proceeding. So That Camp is sort of bootstrapping into a publishing unit as well. And via Twitter, lots of other people are mentioning other conferences. ALA, JCDL, Joint Conference on Digital Libraries, is going to have a That Camp. So
I know DLF is. I'm not sure JCDL is.
Maybe it looks like it's a joint between them.
Oh, it could be.
So I think the movement of That Camp is getting past the Seinfeld problem of being about nothing and trying to explain that to administrators who are confused about why they'd want a day of about nothing where something happens, but they don't know in advance what happens. That's a terrifying thing. I thought we had a question in the back there. No? Don't make me go to my well of boring stories from the internet here. How many people is this is their first that camp of any that camp, not prime, just any that camp at all? Woo! All right, it's more than half the audience. Very, very, very impressive. How many people this is their 10th that camp? You've got to be in the 10
it's
club.
It's way more. It's way over
20.
10.
No, 20.
I'm probably 10.
It's over a dozen for me.
I think I'm 7.
It's maybe 14, 15.
Probably 10.
No. Okay. Okay, well, while people are thinking, I will have to go back to my well here. We don't want to talk about Google Books more, do we?
No.
Gosh. What stories do you hate when we talk about? Come on, people on the Twitter. What stories do you never want to hear us discuss again?
Udacity.
MOOCs in general, not popular.
Okay. So I had a comment. Who was I? I was talking to Peter Hurdle, a guest of the show from a couple episodes ago, who works in the Cornell Libraries, copyright guru. I was talking to him earlier in the week, and he mentioned something that I thought was kind of interesting. He says that we used to talk much more about tech in general, our focus has become narrower and narrower over time. And he used to rely on us for like telling him about the new, iMac or something. And we don't do that quite as much anymore. I wonder if we should, this is all inside. Website recommendations. Maybe be a little more, less narrow in our focus.
Yeah.
That's probably my fault because I kind of tend to be the one who says, that doesn't have anything to do with higher education. But I can back off that.
Yeah,
I can stop using that voice.
do we have other things in the well?
I want to talk about France. Je veux parler au sujet de France pour un moment. So as it turns out, there is an analogous lawsuit to the U.S. Authors Guild lawsuit about the Google Books project that has been going on. The U.S. one dates back to 2005. The French one was actually brought not by the Authors Guild but by the Society of Men of Letters in France. But they have actually settled that lawsuit, and they have settled it such that Google can now sell ebook versions of the texts it digitized in France. And I find this interesting just because France in particular has long been a tremendous objector to a lot of the things that Google has been doing in general, not just scanning books, but lots of other things that Google has been doing. So I found it interesting that they were able to settle, whereas in the United States we were not. I think it may honestly have to do with the fact that their literary and cultural establishment is a little bit more cohesive, perhaps, historically than ours is in the U.S., even though the Authors Guild did just get authorized as a class. I'm not sure. In France, I think that always sort of felt like it was the case. I don't think anybody else even wants to talk about this. I wanted to just say that I thought it was interesting, but we have John coming up to the microphone to speak a little bit about this.
Also stare right into that camera and get really
close. Hello there.
Scare the audience.
Exactly. I'm actually being a good Samaritan and posing a Twitter question for you all.
Yes,
friend of that camp is asking about someone from small liberal arts colleges suggested that history faculty were too ambitious, but English faculty could envision smaller, more realistic DH projects. Have you seen that phenomenon elsewhere? And can you point to feasible DH projects for historians at small liberal arts colleges? That also gives me an opportunity to pose the question from Mark Sample's tweets earlier in the week about the largest divide in digital humanities being between historians and literature people. You want to comment on that in the context of
this? Sharks and jets sort of thing.
That was a tweet. Now, that seemed a lot longer than a tweet. That was I was counting the characters there. Two tweets? Wow.
My tweets are magical.
God, they are magical. I do think it's a kind of interesting question. You know, we're three quarters historians here and one quarter lit. Although the longer she stays with us, we're converting her. You want to start off, and we'll.
Yeah. Well. There's two questions, right? I have an easy answer to the first one. Quite frankly, I of course I teach a great many Omeka workshops, and I'm working at the place that develops Omeka. But quite frankly, I do think that the somewhat old-fashioned, non-cutting-edge task of putting cool stuff online in a scholarly fashion is not to be denigrated, and is something that liberal arts colleges and faculty who work at liberal arts colleges can do. And Omeka is, quite frankly, a really good system for creating scholarly collections online easily. Is it fancy? Is it going to get you $250,000 grant? No. I still consider it to be digital humanities. It's certainly a stepping stone into digital projects. And I think that holds true for most humanities disciplines at small institutions as well. I actually really think that putting things online in a scholarly way, whether that's creating a scholarly edition of a text or whether that's creating a scholarly collection online, is the best possible introduction to digital humanities. One of the things it teaches you, besides standards of digitization and all of that, is about engagement with the public on the internet. And I think that's a huge part of digital humanities. Now, about disciplinary divides between English and history. What do I have to say about that? It surprises me actually to hear something that I hear sometimes, you know, that, I don't know, that English is more experimental, or that they're more open to digital humanities or something than historians. I'm not sure I've found that to be the case. Maybe I've just been running with the wrong crowd, with these, you know, digital history pioneers at the Center for History and New Media. I think that the disciplinary values may be so similar that I would rather emphasize those than the distinctions between the disciplines, quite frankly. And I happen to be a literary historian as well, so it wasn't, although I like to kid about, you know, being the only English person in a room full of historians, I actually haven't found it to be that jarring in terms of values. So I suppose I'd, you know, naively and idealistically would rather emphasize those.
Yeah, I kind of want to disagree a little bit on this point, because I think that actually people in English are more open to digital humanities than people in history. I've written about this a number of times, so it's not news to anybody who's been reading what I've been writing, but I think as a tribe, historians are very conservative, and when it comes to that which matters. I think they're very innovative in terms of bringing new voices into the study of the past. I think they're very innovative in thinking about what kinds of sources can be used to make sense of the past. So I think that they're not conservative in that way. And I'm not talking about political views at all. I think that when it comes, though, to the sort of fundamental standards of the discipline, I think historians are an incredibly conservative tribe. And I think that it's really easy for us to miss that here at a place like George Mason, which is not conservative in that way. I mean, our colleagues in the history department here are in the Let a Thousand Flowers Bloom part of the world. But I think as a tribe, historians are just really generally very conservative. I think it's changing, but I think it changes very slowly in our discipline. And so I think my own sense is sort of out there in the wider world, people in English and literary studies are more open to innovation in the digital humanities.
I don't disagree with that, Mills. I guess what I would say, though, is where I would say the split is in the audience for digital history versus digital lit crit. Digital history has a very, its pedigree is at least certainly here at the center and in many other places, it has a pedigree, a kind of public history pedigree. You know, it comes out of public historical, the public historical work of the 1970s and 1980s, a lot of it. And so the audience for a lot of digital history is a general audience, a public audience, an audience not of our peers, but of people outside the university, outside the discipline, and a lot of and I think that a lot of the pedigree of the literature side of digital humanities comes more out of computational linguistics and more out of scholarly editions. So the audience for digital lit tends to be more a scholarly audience, an internal audience, and that may explain some of the willingness to experiment, that it's that the things that the literature people are doing are aimed at their colleagues, you know, that they're aimed at changing the discipline, whereas things we're doing oftentimes our colleagues may not even take any notice of. I mean, a lot of the projects we do at the center will never be used by our colleagues. They're never even marketed or promoted to our colleagues. Our colleagues are kind of unaware of them in a way that's not true you want your colleagues to absolutely be aware of the work you're doing in literature.
I'm not sure I have anything to add. there's been some questions about tools and things like that. We haven't discussed tools in a while. I hate to put people on the spot, but there's this great site called First Five that I think a graduate student in communication studies runs, of just asking people what the first five things are that they look at online in the morning are. First thing in the morning. So would it be okay if we go around the horn?
Don't start with me.
Okay. Is that all right? Great.
I have an iPhone app. Actually, I know not everybody has an iPhone, but now I forgot the name of it. It's a podcasting app, actually. I believe it's called Caster. Oh, crap. That's not actually the name of it. Never mind. Tom, do you have something?
So I look at Twitter, and I have a list, a Twitter list called Links, and it follows people who link a lot. I have all my friends on Twitter who may or may not link a lot, but then I have a list of people who I follow who tend to post links, and so I look at that to find interesting stories. I look at Google Reader. I have less than I used to, but maybe still 50 feeds in Google Reader that I look at. I don't know if I can come up with five. But actually, increasingly, I've been looking at, I've been using Stellario or Stellar.io, which is a new web application which you follow people, and it aggregates the things that they have favorited or liked, favorited on Twitter or liked on Facebook, and it gives you a list of just that stuff. So it's just the stuff the people you're following are favoriting, which is kind of an interesting way to think about finding interesting news. That's DH Now. That's another one that I tend to look at most days. So that's four.
The tool that I was trying to think of is actually called Pocket Casts, because I actually do get a lot of my information auditorily rather than, because I have a long commute and this and that. Roger Whitson, whom I believe is in the audience, had once recommended an app called Stitcher, which Digital Campus is on. Stitcher is nice for random podcasts, related podcasts. It's good for doing that. And so I do use it to find different things that way. I tend to stick to the same podcasts over and over again, I will say, and Pocket Casts is better for that. So it'll give me, for some reason, I've been listening to a lot of stuff about economics lately, but also tech news. There are several very good tech news podcasts and Digital Campus on Pocket Casts.
Great. You ready?
I actually start the day with the Washington Post in the print edition. I still like to get the ink on. I will be the last subscriber of the Washington Post, and I'll be the last person to have black fingertips from all the ink. But then I switch to Flipboard on my phone because that not only aggregates various news feeds, but also Google Reader and people, my friends' Flickr feeds, which I like to take a look at, and so various things like that. So I found Flipboard to be really helpful of sort of pulling a whole lot of things together in one place, and that's cut down on going from one to another. From there, I tend to look at the WashingtonPost.com to see what's changed since I looked at the newspaper, and then I look at the clock to see what time I have to wake up my 15-year-old, and that usually is the end of it for me. If I have time, I check my email briefly.
So my honest list, I probably check email first thing, probably on my phone. And I just was looking at my tabs. I mean, almost the entire suite of Google stuff, Gmail, Google Calendar, and Google Reader. I'm still a very heavy Google Reader fan, and I really like Reader with two E's, actually three E's, I guess, on the iPad. For accessing Reader, and there's a great new version out, 3.0, that's even better. I'm a huge Instapaper and Reader user. Anything that strips out ads and gets me to the text I want to read tends to be a favorite at breakfast. I also am a big podcast user. I use Podcaster on the iPhone only because it was like the first podcast app that was approved, and I'd like a better one because
Pocket
it's
Caster.
Terrible. Pocket Caster, okay. And then Twitter. I'm still using TweetDeck 0.38.2, which really was the classic TweetDeck. I'm getting a lot of approving nods from the audience now before Twitter bought TweetDeck, so it's still the Adobe Air version, which maybe that's a bad thing, but it still seems to work. I tried Jennetter, which I think I turned a few people on, which is from Japan. So the default is the Japanese language version, but you can make it an English language version. And if you like lots of emojis around your tweets from your serious colleagues in history, that's a great one to go to as well. You have thought of something else? Yes.
Well, I didn't want to leave people with the impression that I don't read. I have that much intellectual pride left in me. I do read. And I will say that I, for some reason, have never been able to get into the habit of going to an RSS reader. And so I actually wind up having a lot of things sent to my email. I've got, you know, Inside Higher Ed sent to my email, The Chronicle sent to my email. To be honest, I get a lot of my news from The Chronicle and the Inside Higher Ed. They report on, you know, the earthquake's effects on higher education. I was like, there was an earthquake? Wow, okay, great. But I also use ifttt.com, if this, then that, to generate emails to my inbox from blogs and things like that. I have Kathleen Fitzpatrick's blog, Planned Obsolescence, goes to my inbox. Other people's blogs go to my inbox like that. Yours does, too. Yours does. Mark Sample's blog comes to my email inbox. I know it's geeky, or it's non-geeky is what it is. It's square.
Yeah, I have a brutal sort of Darwinian Google Reader setup where I use the folders as tags, and I have an A category for bloggers who make it up into the must-read category. So I'm looking out there. There's some people who are in that category, but then a lot of others are in
some in the B category too.
Or heading to B. Yeah. Any other questions from the audience? I know someone ahead of time asked for an update from Mills about hoaxing. Can we put you on the spot for a quick update? Okay.
Well, the good news about the hoax controversy surrounding me is that it seems to be over. The internet has now moved on to other more interesting topics, and so the hate mail that I've been receiving has largely disappeared. Actually, the session that I did in the workshop this morning really was feeding off of some of that, and because as I've been looking through all of the news about and the various discussions online about the course that I taught this past semester, Lying About the Past, one of the things that, one of the lessons for me that emerged from that is that several hundred thousand people, because at least 300,000 looked at the Atlantic story about the course, and since it showed up in so many other places, probably another couple hundred thousand in other ways, several hundred thousand people around the world spent at least a couple of minutes thinking about how history ought to be taught and what was right and wrong about the way that I was teaching the class. And so to me as an educator, that's really worth it, because it's worth some hate mail and one death threat, because the death threat I could have done without, but it was worth it in the sense that it meant that at least for a few minutes, people really thought about something that I care a lot about, and I think a lot of people clearly care a lot about, given the sort of level of emotion around this, and that is how we ought to teach young people about the past. So that's kind of my summary of what it all meant to have all that controversy.
Yes. Ask it and I'll repeat it. The question was asking Mills, during the emotion and of the firestorm, what were you thinking? When was it going to die down, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I figured it was going to die down fairly quickly just because, in the grand scheme of things, it's a really small story. and for sure that the internet would move on to other things fairly rapidly. So I wasn't worried that it was going to continue. Those people here or watching who read my blog noticed I went offline for a couple of days, and that was really just because I was getting so relentlessly spammed by a couple of people. And I was out of the country. I was in Romania working on a wireless connection from the Danube Delta in a village of 450 people called Mila 23, Mile 23. And so, you know, it was really hard to deal with all of that spam going on, which is why I just took it down. And it was in the midst of that I got this one death threat, which I learned I actually really like our campus police for the way that they handled it. But I knew it was going to end fairly quickly because it's just not that big a deal. For me, one of the things that I thought was very interesting, and I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out, was a conversation on some of the Wikipedia editor sites about whether to entirely block George Mason University from access to Wikipedia. And that's a really interesting conversation to read, because there's a lot of emotion in that conversation, and there's a lot of cool heads in that conversation. So you see, one of the real values of Wikipedia is that it's a place where kind of all opinions got out there, and the final result of the conversation was that the cooler heads prevailed, as they were going to, blocking an entire university over the actions of a professor whose students created two entirely true Wikipedia entries, that would have been a little excessive. But it was interesting to watch that unfolding. I was just kind of sitting there like a fly on the wall watching those and wondering, like, okay, well, what would happen if all of a sudden all IP addresses on this campus were blocked from Wikipedia? What would the reaction to that be, and what would I say if somebody called me about it? And they weren't going to be able to call me in Mila 23 in Romania, but they would call me when I got back. So that's some of the stuff I was thinking about.
Great. Any other questions?
So the question, for those who couldn't hear, is like, what happens a couple of years from now if someone does a Google search on some of the fake history that my students created? And what would happen from that? Well, if they do a Google search, they are led to the pages which say this was a hoax, and so for instance, the course 4 years ago, the hoax was Edward Owens' Last American Pirate, and if you Google or Yahoo or whatever search Edward Owens, the first or second thing you come to is the Wikipedia entry, which is about the hoax, not about Edward Owens' The Last American Pirate. And given the dominance of sites like Wikipedia in those search returns, that's what's going to show up. If you Google the two hoaxes that my students created this semester, you get results that lead to me and my blog about hoaxing about those things, not about the things themselves. In fact, they kind of disappear very quickly. So it would be really interesting to see, you know, as you say, several years from now, because that's one of the conversations that I had with my students, was that we were not going to be in the business of creating zombie facts that you just can't kill, sort of like Hitler's Jewish grandmother, the zombie fact that just won't die. And so we had a long conversation about that and how we would make sure that that wouldn't happen. And one of the ways that you make sure that that wouldn't happen is that the things that people link to later are the things which say, this was a hoax.
Question is, did it make it into Snopes?
No, it did not make it into Snopes. That shows you how small it actually was.
Great. Well, we hear via the Twitters that Ustream splices in ads to the streaming video. And the last one, which many people are still at work watching this broadcast, was for Playboy body spray. So so people watching at home got a much more exciting live digital campus. So we thank Playboy for their sponsorship. Do we get a deal on that? I want to thank Chris. I know. We don't get a chance to do this at all, but Chris Preparato is our manager, sound guy.
He's not usually our sound guy. He's not responsible for the usual terrible quality of our sound. He is our sound guy today only.
Right. Any good stuff comes from Chris. All the lousy sound on the podcast comes from us. So we thank you for tuning in. Thanks to many people who tuned in online, and we'll see you for non-live episode 89 in 2 weeks. Thanks very much.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.